Today's Teisho will be on case 88 in the Hikigan Roku, the Piyen Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 88 is entitled Gensha's Man of Three Disabilities. Engo's introduction. In his teaching, the master often turns two into three. Talking of the profound, he goes through and through it, seven times piercing and eight times breaking through. He adapts himself to all circumstances, penetrates the most mysterious secrets. Acting on the principles of the Buddhas, he leaves no trace of his actions. Where do the complicated koans come from? If you have an eye to see, see the following. Main subject, Gensha said to the assembly, every teacher in the land talks of saving things and delivering humankind. When a person of three disabilities comes to you, how do you deal with him? A blind man does not see you holding the hosu. A deaf person does not hear your words. A dumb person will not talk even if you want him to. How do you approach him? If you cannot, Buddhism can bestow no benefit. A monk asked Umon about this topic. Umon said, make your bows. The monk did so. Umon made as if to push the monk with his staff. The monk retreated, and Umon said, you are not blind. Then he said, come close to me. The monk approached. Umon said, you are not deaf. Umon asked the monk, do you understand? The monk replied, no, I don't understand. Umon said, see, you're not dumb. The monk attained an insight. Secho's verse, blind, deaf, and dumb, none can come near. Throughout the country, no one could understand. Riro did not discern the true color, nor Shiko the subtle sound. Let us sit quietly by the window and enjoy the falling leaves, the spring flowers. I say, do you understand? It is a holeless iron hammer. Thank you all very much for coming to practice on this Saturday morning. So this is the koan, basically a Zen teacher named Gensha said to his students, a blind man does not see you holding the hosu, a deaf person does not hear your words, a dumb person will not talk, even if you want him to. How do you approach him? And if you can't approach him, then Buddhism won't help. So that's the koan. Basically, the turning word, the word you would meditate on this koan, is disability or disabilities. So, you know, the way koans work is that they usually have a little story, a little vignette. and there's some kind of a question that the teacher poses. And generally, it's possible to come up with an intellectual answer. But that's really not what the koan is asking you to do. The koan is asking you to internalize the story and then to recite the turning phrase or the turning word like a mantra. So, you know, basically the idea is that you would sit down on the cushion and you would go into samadhi, into wuxing, and you would begin to say disability, disability, disability. And of course, you know, we all understand disabilities as a problem. We understand disabilities as a problem, something we have to overcome. So, you know, the question Gensha poses to his monks is, how do you overcome these disabilities? You know, one way to understand this koan is to think about what we've been reading in the Lotus Sutra. We've been reading in the Lotus Sutra about the burning house. If you haven't had a, if you have not been participating in the Sutra study group, I understand everybody's very busy, but it's a wonderful opportunity to expose yourself to other ways of to another way of deepening your practice. And reading the sutras is definitely a wonderful way to deepen your practice. It definitely, it's inspiring, and it gives you a kind of support to your practice. So the Lotus Sutra has a scene which is very famous in East Asian Buddhism, where basically the Buddha is representing the world as a burning house. And he says, the house is on fire, but nobody notices it's on fire. Everybody's inside, and they're so busy playing with their toys that they won't come out of the house, even when they're called out of the house. And the Buddha is talking about this as sort of like the basic problem, is that people are people are fascinated by the illusions that they create. And their fascination with those illusions prevents them from responding to real emergencies, but also to their real situation, which is an emergency. And, you know, we were discussing this scene the other night in our Sutra study group, and it seems so appropriate, right? I mean, people are, basically, we have all of this information about, say, global warming and planetary climate change. And it's a real crisis, right? I was just reading in the paper the other day that we're in the middle of what scientists call the sixth great extinction. They say that basically what's happening to species all over the world is this catastrophic decline. And I myself, you can see it for yourself, right? I mean, for example, I have in my yard, I have planted clover, white clover. And clover is wonderful for your yard. You can get a bag of clover for $5. And if you put clover in your grass, you don't need to fertilize your grass to the same degree. Clover is nitrogen fixing, and it will pull nitrogen out of the air and put it in the ground, and the grass will be very healthy. So, I have planted clover in the yard in order not to have to depend on fertilizers. And the result is wonderful. And I have like a field right now of, because I haven't mowed the grass, I have a field of clover with these beautiful white flowers. And if you walk through the yard, you know, you'll notice there are no bees on the clover flowers, which is really, if you're my age, that's extraordinary. You know, when I was a little kid growing up in Baltimore, Maryland, we also used to have clover in the grass before DuPont and some of these other big chemical companies got in the business of selling grass seed. They always used to include clover in the grass seed mix. So when you sowed your lawn, you'd get this wonderful fertilizer. But, of course, the companies that want to sell you fertilizer don't want you to get free fertilizer, so there's no clover in grass seed anymore. But when I was growing up, it was commonplace to put clover in the grass. And so I would walk. We lived in an apartment in Baltimore. If you know Baltimore, we lived near Lock Raven Boulevard. And there was an apartment complex, and they'd sown clover, and you had to be careful walking through the grass not to step on a bee. There were so many bees. And if you were barefoot, you were almost sure to get stung. And I remember walking through the grass and somebody telling me, you're going to get stung. And I said, oh, no, I won't. And I immediately got stung. And I remember crying. I was just a little kid. They took me into the house and I was crying. And so I wore shoes after. So many bees, all gone. There are no bees. So, most people don't notice this because they're in their houses, right? You know, they don't come out. People don't like the heat. Maybe they're in the air conditioning. They don't walk outside. There's plenty to do in the house, right? I mean, you can watch TV, or if TV has become passé, you can go online and you can spend the day just on the computer, just surfing, you know. So, you know, the interesting thing is that we're caught up in this planetary situation where we know intellectually that we have a big problem, and we know we have to change, but we don't change. Right. So it's so much like the parable of the burning house in the Lotus Sutra, where you're saying, how do you get people out of the burning house? How do you get them to change their ways? So this koan is sort of talking about that in a way. You know, the idea that, you know, a person who is blind, deaf, and dumb, how do you communicate with that person? How do you liberate that person or get that person to change her life or change his life in a way that will be truly liberating and life-enhancing? So that's sort of what the koan is all about. And when you sit down on the cushion, and you know, to some degree, we're all like that person in the burning house, you know, whether the subject is the environment or something else, right? How do we really get in contact with reality? Because so often we're not in contact with reality. You know, even though many people assume that's the case, you know, every once in a while we realize it's like there's this invisible wall between us and life, right? And we're wondering, how do I get through that wall? And, you know, you can go out to dinner at a nice restaurant and have a good meal. That doesn't necessarily put you in touch with, you know, it doesn't get you through that wall. You know, so I think we all feel some sense of maybe the separation or the artificiality of our life, right? How do we really live deeply? So all of this is behind the koan, okay? All of this. And, you know, sit down on the cushion and you say, disabilities, disabilities, disabilities. So, you know, let me deviate just a little bit from the koan to say, you know, there's this wonderful woman that you may not have ever heard of, but her name was Jane Jacobs, Jane Jacobs. And Jane Jacobs was a architecture and city design critic in the 1950s and 60s. And what was happening to New York was, at that period, was that people had decided that New York had to be turned into a modern city. And that meant that they had to design very tall buildings and had to straighten the streets. And basically, all of these really Ivy League trained city planners went into New York and started wholesale reconstruction of New York. And they would build these very tall skyscrapers, very impressive buildings. And on paper, it all looked beautiful. These planned cities looked beautiful. But one of the things that Jane Jacob noticed was that once you come into an area and you tear down all the old buildings, and you plan it out. You build the skyscrapers, and you basically have an area here where people can eat their lunch, and an area here where people can catch the bus, and an area here where people can look in the pond. You know, all of this makes sense, but she noticed that when you do that, the people aren't there. They don't like to be in those spaces. And she noticed that when you go into parts of the city, like Greenwich Village other parts of New York that aren't, we haven't been redesigned in that way, you know, there's this very vibrant street life, a very vibrant street life. I was reading recently about Chinese cities. And, you know, in China, in Beijing, they used to have these neighborhoods called, well, they were Hutong. And Hutong were like a thousand. Some of the there are parts of Japan that are like this too, like in Kyoto. There are streets that are like 1,000 years old, and they appeared without any central planning. Right, people just built them, and everybody's sort of doing their own thing. But they create this really vibrant neighborhood without any central planning, basically. And what's happening in Beijing and other Chinese cities now is that the big city planners are coming in and they're tearing down all of these neighborhoods that were, you know, ground level, spontaneous communities and putting in these planned communities. And actually, all of these studies show people don't like to be there. They'd rather be actually on like a dirty street that's sort of windy, where there you can just sit down and talk, and people can play mahjong, or they can have a glass of tea and smoke cigarettes, you know, on the curb. Actually, people prefer that. So Jacobs was one of the first people who points out that, you know, planning doesn't necessarily produce a better city. She said it's actually better to let people have a say in how they use the space they live in. Yeah. Let them have a say in how they use the space they live in. And that when people are able to participate in making the city, they're happier. So Jacob said, you know, big centralized planning is not a good idea. It's much better to let people be spontaneous, even though they don't have a plan. And since she has done her research, there was a huge argument about this, because all of these city planners thought that was a ridiculous idea. But later, people began to take her ideas very seriously. And the idea that cities grow organically, not with central planning, is something that has really taken hold in design circles, right? So the idea is to not try to plan everything out. Let people experiment with spaces and so on. You know, one of the things that is so interesting, for me anyway, is that, you know, we live in an age of planning, right? I was just reading something the other day about how, people have begun to use computers and computer modeling to predict economic outcomes. And now we have this huge data, these huge data banks, right? And so people are using like big data to produce these very elaborate algorithms that tell us where we'll be 15, 20 years from now. And the interesting thing the article pointed out is that actually the results of these very data-heavy algorithms is not good. It's like we get more and more information, but actually the outcomes are not very good. You know, just yesterday I was listening to a program on public radio about the economy, and we're talking about the possibility that we will have like runaway inflation. And so the reporter did a survey. She had a list of like distinguished economists. And she called them up, and then she presented her results on the radio show. And she said, here are the results. I asked these economic experts, are we going to have runaway inflation or not? And the result was about 25% said yes. About 25% said no. And 50% said they aren't sure. It's like, you need a PhD for that, you know? So nobody knows. So, I know, We believe in rational planning, and yet, you know, actually, our plans often don't work out. At least they don't work out the way we planned. And it's often the case that if plans succeed, it's not because the plans get carried out as planned, but because people change them as they go along. Mm-hmm. So I think we create plans in life. We create plans to reassure ourselves that we'll know what to do when we come up against something that we don't understand or that is genuinely unknown. But I think, you know, relying on the plan is a kind of superstition almost. It's almost like a superstition. Because, you know, actually, we need to trust, or at least a lot of evidence suggests that what we really need to do is trust our ability to respond spontaneously to events. I think that planning is, if I may say so, highly overrated. Now, I do think you should have look at your bank account. You should make some financial plans. You should have a retirement account, and so on. But I think that we become the prisoners of our own plans in life a lot of the time. You know, we make plans, and then, you know, because we think we should stick to the plan, we don't appreciate what's actually happening around us. So, you know, I have a friend of mine whose name I won't reveal, but his parents were both distinguished musicians. His father was a friend of this famous Finnish composer named Sibelius. If you're a classical music fan, you might know who Sibelius is. And his music is quite beautiful. And my friend's father was a personal friend of Sibelius, and Sibelius used to come. There's a big Finnish community in Seattle, and Sibelius used to come and stay. When he would on the West Coast, he would stay with my friend's father. And so, you know, my friend's parents were both like musicians, and they planned for him a career in the music world. And apparently his sister became a Broadway performer, very famous Broadway performer, who married to a very famous actor named Burgess Meredith. If you've ever heard of Burgess Meredith, his sister and Burgess Meredith were married at one time. And so, you know, this was the life that was planned out for him. And, you know, he himself bought into this idea that this was how he was going to live. So, you know, his early life was spent training to be a great musician. He's talked to me about his musical training. You know, his parents, at the time he was about 5 years old, would say, you're going to be a great concert pianist. And he had one of the best piano teachers in the Northwest, this woman who was very famous piano teacher. And he said that what she used to do was put two little like shot glasses on his hands when he played the piano, filled with water. And he had to play the piano with such stability that the water wouldn't spill, wouldn't even shake. His hands had to be so steady. You know, basically, he was like a prodigy, as it turns out. His parents got him into music when he was very young. He could play the piano without spilling any water in the shot glasses. He was apparently quite a talented musician. And so his parents put him out into the world of music. And he would actually do performances when he was like 12 years old. He would perform and get notes. You know, people would say, oh, this young man is going to be the next Van Cliburn, you know, the next great pianist, right? And he said everything was going well until he fell into deep depression. Just like as the way he put it is, he said, I had a nervous breakdown. He had to perform. He fell apart in the middle of a performance. He went backstage and he just could not go back to music. I think it took him a long time to realize that there was something in him that didn't want to do this, right? But the plan was so clear, you know? And I think he wasn't able to listen to those voices in himself that were saying, this is not what I want. This is not what I want. So anyway, my friend had to, recover from his nervous breakdown. And he had a period in his life where he didn't know what he wanted to do. His parents sort of gave up on the dream of producing the next musical prodigy. And he went to the University of Chicago. And just by chance, he took a course on East Asian art. I think it was taught by a man named Kitayama, very famous historian. It was like he came alive, right? He went into this, he just picked this class, he didn't tell me why, but he just said he picked this class sort of on the spur of the moment. He walked in and, from the minute he started looking at these pictures, he was in love, right? It was just like something inside himself came alive. Basically, his life was transformed by a few moments of a few unexpected, unanticipated, and unplanned for moments. Actually, this person eventually went to Japan and to study Japanese painting, learn Japanese, and went to do his dissertation on very famous Japanese painting called The Five Persimmons. If you've ever seen it, it's like a priceless Japanese national treasure. And it, at that time, it was in a temple. It was in Yoshinji. And so my friend went to Yoshinji to research the Five Persimmons. And now he wanted to be a professor of art history, and his PhD dissertation was going to be on this particular artist whose name escapes me right now. And he went to the abbot of Yoshinji and said, I want to study the Five Persimmons. And the abbot said, well, you can't study the Five Persimmons if you don't do Zen. And this really happened. And so my friend started doing Zen meditation so he could understand the Five Persimmons. It's like 8 years later, he became a monk, and 8 years later, he came back to the United States, and he finished his dissertation on the Five Persimmons. He said that he had been at the temple for about a year, or I think it might have been a little longer, but he finally got to see the Five Persimmons. He went into the outhouse, and there was a little table. If you know anything about Japanese outhouses, they have a hole on the floor. So he got up from the hole in the floor, he washed his hands, and he looked over on this little table, and there were the scroll, this famous national treasure, the Five Persimmons. Another unexpected event. This is a real story. Everything here is absolutely true. And I think many people could tell stories like this. I was reading about this psychologist I like very much. He went to college to be a I guess he wanted to be a fiction writer. His goal was to be to write fiction. He loved literature. And he wanted to sign up for this literature class, but it was filled. So he took a psychology class because it fit his schedule. He became this professional psychologist. He's published 5 books and gives talks. Again, an accident changed his life. So, I think it's really, I think planning is important, you need to balance your checkbook. But actually, I think we spend too much of our lives planning and not enough being open to the possibilities, right? These are two stories about real people who were completely transformed when their lives went off the tracks. And they were transformed by something they hadn't imagined would be the case for them. And by the way, the first person in the first person I talked about still loves music, right? Became an art historian, became a Zen teacher. He used to be at our sesshins. This person would be at our sesshins. And at one time we had a sesshin, and we were holding it in a rented facility where they actually had a grand piano. They had a performance space in this retreat center. And I was packing up to leave, and I heard this beautiful music coming out of the auditorium. And I went inside, and there was our friend playing the piano beautifully. So, he didn't have to give up his music, but his life was changed by something he didn't expect. The thing is that we usually aren't open to those experiences. In the case of my friend, the first person I talked about, he was, he had given up on his plan in a way. It was just drifting. But, it's often the case that we hold on so tightly to our plans that we can't be open to what's in front of us in the moment. And, we do this all the time. It's not just life plans. The way we experience our everyday lives is often just like this, right? So, it's very difficult for people to just have an experience. Usually, as things are unfolding, we already have a little plan in our heads. If I get up in the morning and I want to have breakfast, that's a little plan. So I go downstairs and I'm focused on, putting on the tea, getting out the soy yogurt or whatever, getting the rice out of the refrigerator and cutting up the tofu, whatever. You have tunnel vision. And when you eat your food, maybe hardly you don't even taste it, right? Because your experience of the moment is so heavily controlled by your forethought, by your imagined outcome, that you can't really be fully in the moment. I can remember some of the best moments at sesshin have been waiting for breakfast. Right? So, you're sitting if you come to our sesshin, our wonderful sesshin at Murray Grove, if you're sitting waiting for breakfast, the breakfast hasn't been served, you're at the table, and you're waiting for the sutras to be recited and so on and so on. You're just sitting there. I remember the last time I was there, I was just sitting there waiting for everything to start. And I noticed there were hummingbirds in the garden. I could see through the window these beautiful hummingbirds. And I was just, you know, watching these hummingbirds come and go. There were like four of them around this feeder and around the flowers. You know, never would have noticed that if there hadn't been a pause in the routine. And later I talked to the director of that facility and I said, oh, you have so many beautiful hummingbirds. And she said, we do? I've never seen one. You know, so it was like these little interruptions in our plans, in our forethought, right, allow us to experience the world. And, you know, usually those moments are really rich. They're really, it's like suddenly you get into connection. You know, it's definitely the case that we need to make plans, but often the plans have the effect of separating us from the world around us. Everything just becomes like a tool, like our tool, right? So there's an expression in English that if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I'm sure you've heard that, right? It's like if you have a hammer, you're going to look at everything. You're going to look everywhere for something to hit with your hammer, right? So everything becomes your nail. And that's a very deep, it's not Zen, but it's very deep, right? It's like when we have a purpose, everything fits the purpose, and anything that doesn't fit the purpose is unimportant. You know, but, and so everything becomes our tool. This is a problem that humans have. But when we are able to not have a purpose, when we are able to be open, just open, present without a purpose, you know, amazing, you know, your life can be transformed. You know, the Chinese have this idea, wu wei, wu wei, wu wei. It can be translated as no effort, no effort. But really, I think a better translation would be no purpose, no purpose. You know, it's like when we are not acting with a purpose, when we are present without a purpose, we are open in a way that we can't normally be open. I don't know if anybody has. There's a wonderful. The name of the movie is. Oh, is it Castaway? Castaway. I think that might be it. There's a wonderful movie with Tom Hanks, I think that's the title. But anyway, he is a federal. He works for Federal Express or one of these companies, and he's on an air route. And the plane crashes, and he survives and lives on an island. He finally gets off the island after many years and many struggles, and he's rescued. And then he goes home, and he's been planning all this time. He's been thinking after years stranded on this island, he would go home, be back with his wife. And, of course, everybody thought he was dead. His wife is remarried. The place in the world for him is gone. And there's a wonderful scene at the end of the movie where he actually, on that flight, he had a package that never got delivered. And he's actually going to this is like 5 years after the package was mailed. He's taking this package to the person who owned it, who is supposed to receive it. And he's driving in the middle of, like, Texas. It's totally flat. And he's looking for this person's house. And it turns out that the person the package is addressed to actually drives by. And he doesn't know it yet. But he'll figure it out. But the point is, at the end of the movie, he's in this flat plain, and the roads go in four directions. And, you know, actually I thought that was so beautiful because, you know, his whole life was planned, and his plans went completely awry. And at the end of this movie, he's at this crossroads and he can go in any direction. You know, and I think for a person who is unprepared for that experience, it's terrifying. You know, because we've got to get to point from point A to point B. But, you know, actually, that's the most magical place. Crossroads is magical. Because, you know, any direction is going to take you somewhere new. You know, any direction is going to take you somewhere. The crossroads, actually, is like a sacred place, right? Because anything can happen. And even though we're afraid of being on a crossroads, you know, in the middle of nowhere, northeast, south, and west, which will we choose? You know, that's the most open kind of moment. So you know, a lot of Zen practice is learning how to be at that crossroads, learning how to be unengaged, learning how to be in a state of wu wei, right? No purpose. You know, when we're given a koan, we're supposed to, so, quote-unquote, solve the koan. So, you know, people want to answer their koan, just like you want to get a merit badge if you're a Boy Scout, or you want to get a black belt if you're studying karate, right? But, you know, you sit down on the cushion, and the more you want to answer the koan, the more you rely on what you already know. See, what you already know. And actually, what you already know is often the least valuable thing you have. Really. It's often the least valuable thing you have. When you get stuck, what you already know is often the least valuable thing you have. You know, what would be helpful is what you don't know. Right? If that makes any sense. When you're stuck because your habits are blocking you. A friend of mine who's a psychotherapist said, he said, Kurt, it's not what you know that screws things up. It's what you don't know, right? It's what you haven't confronted in yourself. So, and that's invisible to you. So, you know, when people get stuck, they tend to repeat the same behavior over and over again. When people get stuck, they keep trying what worked in the past. And that happens with koan training too. When people get stuck, they just keep repeating. But, you know, repeating the same behavior over and over again doesn't produce, because it worked once, doesn't mean it will work again. And when people keep repeating, they just grind their wheels. Right? This is like a samsara actually needs to go around and around in a circle. So, you know, so even when we know that what we're doing isn't working because it's familiar, we'll continue to do it. So that's human nature, right? You know, but in a way you could say Zen is about learning how to be purposeless. And, you know, for some of us that feels like almost like a sin, right? Almost like a sin. Not to have a plan seems like incredibly irresponsible. Or not to have a purpose. Not to have a purpose. That's very, you're very indulgent. But it's actually not. You know, actually being able to be in a state of purposelessness, of no plan, of no expectation, that takes great courage, but you also have to let yourself go. You know, we define ourselves in terms of our plans, our getting from point A to point B is how we define ourselves. We say, I'm going to do this, and if you do it, you're successful, and if you don't do it, you're unsuccessful. But, you know, that's another kind of repetitive behavior. So you know, basically, Zen is learning how not to have a plan, to be at that crossroads, and being open to the possibilities. And the possibilities always come from out of the blue. They always come from the unexpected place, right? So, you know, I've talked about this many times, but when people are working on their koan, you know, at some point you feel totally blocked by your koan. And that can create all kinds of resentments and anger, as it can in life, right? Being totally blocked is something nobody likes. And then repeating the same behavior over and over again. But, you know, sooner or later, people just sort of give up. And they just begin to be aware without object. It's like consciousness without an object. I was just reading the other day, they said that all these studies show that people are happier in nature. And all these neuroscientists have done all this research about what happens when people go out in nature. And they said consciousness actually changes when we're in nature. And we enter a state of mind which is like unfocused. How did they put it? It's like the mind is interested but not focused. See, I think that's fad. That was so important. I actually underlined it. It's like interested but not focused. It's like zazen. You're alert, but you don't have a goal. It's away. You're not looking for something. You're just looking with interest, right? So people walk through the forest, they're not looking to see a pine tree. They're not looking. Maybe they are going to see a famous mountain or something. But generally speaking, you know, we're out in the woods, we're just walking to walk, and we see this is interesting and this is interesting. This is a different kind of consciousness, right? It's not goal-directed consciousness. It's interested but unfocused. And that's where things come to us, where things that are like karmically transformative come to us, right? So we're waiting for a breakfast, and while we're waiting, we see a hummingbird. You know, that's what Zazen is all about. Humans are not good at being open. They're not good at being unplanned or spontaneous, you know. But Zazen allows us to be open in a way that we normally can't be open. And, you know, actually, the best parts of life are the unplanned parts. That's where things come alive. Generally speaking, you know, if you eat the same thing every day, it can get very tiring. You know, if you say, okay, I've never eaten this before, but I'm going to give it a try. It could be terrible, it could be wonderful, but it'll be memorable, it'll be transformative. So another way to understand disabilities is that we're disabled by our plans. We're disabled by our intentions, you know, our roadmaps. You know, we need roadmaps, but, you know, roadmaps become disabling when they prevent us from experiencing the real openness and beauty of life. So we go into deep wuxian again and again, into that emptiness, and we begin to experience life without a plan. We become the instrument of life, and life is not our tool. We become the vehicle for life energy. You make yourself the tool of life, different relationship with the world. Dogen said, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with the 10,000 things. So to practice Zen is to get rid of your plans. When you get rid of your plans, the self disappears. When the self disappears, you can become one with the 10,000 things. So, yes, it's important to set your alarm clock, but it's also important not to know where you're going. Densha said to the assembly, every teacher in the land talks of saving things and delivering humankind. When a man of three disabilities comes to you, how do you deal with him? A blind man does not see you holding the hosu. A deaf person does not hear your words. A dumb person will not talk even if you want him to. How will you approach him? If you cannot approach him, Buddhism will be of no benefit. a monk asked Uman about this topic. So Densha never explained it. So a monk goes to Uman and says, well, what do you think about this? Uman said, make your vows, something the monk didn't expect. The monk did so. Uman made as if to push the monk with his staff. The monk retreated, and Uman said, you are not blind. He then said, come here. The monk approached. Uman said, you're not deaf. Uman asked the monk, do you understand? The monk said, no, I do not understand. Uman said, you are not dumb. The monk attained an insight. So, you know, we have come here. If somebody asks you, why do you practice Zen? For heaven's sakes, don't have a reason. Okay. Whatever you do, don't have a reason. Because if you had a reason, it wouldn't help. It wouldn't be liberating. It wouldn't be alive. Right? Reasons, we invent reasons after the fact. You know, that's true. We invent our reasons after, you know. Why did you do this? Oh, let me think of a good reason. You know, you should follow your sheen. You should follow that life energy that speaks to you, even if you don't know what it's saying. Secho's verse, blind, deaf, and dumb, none can come near. Enter deep Mushin. Throughout the country, none could understand. Riro did not discern the true color, nor Shiko the subtle sound. Let us sit quietly by the window and enjoy the falling leaves, the spring flowers. I say, do you understand? It's a holeless iron hammer. It's like a hammerhead that has no place for the handle. So you're liberating everything. It's not your tool anymore. It's not a tool. The world is not our tool. The world is our home. It's our true self. So we live in trust. Right? We live in not knowing who she is.